This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest is Clarissa Ward. For the past 5 years, Clarissa Ward has been CNN's chief international correspondent. For more than a decade before joining CNN, she worked first for Fox News and then ABC and later CBS. As an international correspondent, she has repeatedly risked her life to report from the inside about life in war-torn communities across the Middle East, most notably in Syria. In this excerpt from her recently published memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist, she describes one of her first assignments as a fledgling correspondent in Lebanon.
I looked down at the swell of mourners moving toward me. A coffin was held aloft, touched and blessed by 1,000 hands as it swayed down the street. The men carrying it were sweating despite the cool afternoon, pressed in on all sides by chanting protesters. Some of them had caught sight of me and my camera as I had tried to catch up with the cortege, and they cleared the way. They wanted their story of resistance told. I struggled through the crowd and jumped onto a flatbed truck a few yards ahead of the coffin, which was draped with the flag of the Syrian Revolution, 3 red stars rather than the 2 green stars of the official flag. "I can't screw up this shot. I can't screw up this shot," I whispered to myself. Lying in the coffin was a 16-year-old boy who had been shot by Syrian security forces the day before. He had become the latest martyr of the rapidly growing uprising against the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. I took a deep breath and balanced the small point-and-shoot tourism camera on top of the cab of the truck, willing my hands to stay completely still as the coffin approached. I could see the face of the dead boy now, smooth and gray, his eyes closed, his lips parted a fraction. And then he was gone, carried off on the wave of angry mourners. I was on my own in Damascus on my first assignment as a correspondent for CBS News. As a dual citizen with a UK passport, I had managed to obtain a tourist visa, but my producer had not. And I had no cameraman. I had little experience shooting video and did not underestimate the risks of embarking on such an assignment. A journalist traveling alone could easily be disappeared. But I'd been to Syria many times before, spoke enough Arabic to get around on my own, and was desperate to cover the fast-expanding Syrian uprising, which was reaching a boiling point by that fall of 2011. Opposition activists had brought me to the sprawling suburb of Douma to cover the funeral. I had been in Damascus for a few days before I had managed to slip away from my hotel and the ever-present secret police to link up with them. Hundreds of people now poured in from all directions. The women marched together at the back of the procession. Rows and rows of them waved banners with slogans demanding justice and the overthrow of the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Someone started beating a drum, and the crowd hoisted a boy onto a man's shoulders so that he could lead the chant. "Oh, Bashar, you liar," he chanted. "To hell with you and your speech. Freedom is at the door." "Yalla irhal ya Bashar," the crowd chanted, clapping rhythmically. "Get out, Bashar." The chant had become the anthem of the revolution, a revolution gathering strength in the suburbs of Damascus and in Homs and in Hama, and posing a genuine threat to Assad's rule. I looked over the sea of people, cheering and chanting, hands with cell phones raised in the air to capture the protest and beam it out on social media. The crisp November air crackled with the energy and excitement of their voices. Emboldened by their own daring, they grew louder and louder, the clapping thunderous. My foot tapped along with the beat. It was electrifying. "Bashar, screw you and screw those who salute you." These protesters had been waiting for their moment since the Arab Spring unfolded earlier that year, knocking over decades-old dictatorships in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. At the time, Assad had told the Wall Street Journal, "This is the Middle East, where every week you have something new." But he had confidently predicted that the maelstrom would not affect his country. Instead, it would spur reform. He would turn out to be spectacularly wrong on both counts. On March 6, 2011, a group of teenage boys, inspired by the wave of protests spreading across the region, had been arrested for spray-painting "Ashab Yurid Iskat Inizan," "The people want the downfall of the regime," on walls in Dara, a rundown farming town near the Jordanian border. It was the rallying cry of the revolutions in Egypt and Libya, and it brought swift retaliation from local security forces. When the boys were released 2 weeks later, alive but brutalized, their angry families marched on the governor's house to demand justice. They were met with a hail of bullets. Three protesters were killed, and an uprising was born.
Clarissa Ward, reading from her recently published memoir, On All Fronts. I talked to her on the phone from New York.
I wanted to start by, if you'll forgive me, quoting you at yourself. You describing a friend of yours, and you said he's a soft-spoken, thoughtful, and genuinely nice person. In other words, nothing like most conflict reporters. What are most conflict reporters like?
Oh, that's a really good question. Gosh, you definitely win the prize for the most original question. What are most reporters who do this conflict work like? Well, I think stereotypically they're sort of adrenaline junkies, hard-charging, alpha-type personalities, can be a little on the loud side. Vainglorious is an adjective that I have heard used as well. or as my husband said when I met him the first time at a dinner party in Moscow and told him what I did for a living, and he responded, "Oh, I thought most war correspondents are egomaniacs." So I think there are a number of attributes commonly associated with us, but softly spoken is not usually one of them.
You know, it's a somewhat peculiar experience to talk to you because I feel like I know you. Your book reads like a letter from a friend, and the more I read it, the more I kept, when I had to stop reading for one reason or another, I'd be thinking, I want to go back. Let's continue this conversation. And my wife the other day, she said, "My God, I can't believe you're still working and you're reading a book now." And I said, "Oh, you have no idea. This is not work." But for
thank you, that's so nice to hear, because you know it's a little petrifying to sort of put yourself out there like that when you write something so personal and you share it with the world. And it is a slightly surreal moment when you kind of hand it over to the universe. But the best thing that I can hear is that it resonates with people and that they do feel, like you said, that you're just like having a chat with a friend, essentially.
But I certainly can appreciate that feeling, that it takes a lot of courage to do something like that. It's, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to people who write songs and sing them, and it's the same experience. You know, they're writing about things that are so close to them and then standing up in front of a bunch of strangers and sharing it with them. And I think probably as I do, they, and certainly as you have said, you have that sense, I wonder if anybody really gives a hoot.
Yeah, because you're making yourself very vulnerable, and almost worse than criticism is indifference.
Yes, exactly. And you put yourself... Well, I should start by saying that, if you'll forgive the observation, your book is a study in contrasts. Everything about the story you tell, in one sense or another, is counterintuitive. You were a young woman, an attractive young woman, in what the impression I have in a mostly male field. And as we've already established, with a certain kind of personality type that's drawn to situations where you don't know what's going to happen from one minute to the next.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think it's what my parents imagined I would do when I was sort of being sent off to boarding school and tennis lessons and piano lessons. And it was a little bit counterintuitive. And there is something inherently, as you point out, counterintuitive about the idea of people who run towards situations that any sane person would run away from. But I think what sort of does it for me is this sense of the heady pleasure or privilege of witnessing history in the making, of having a front row seat on world events. I mean, that is tremendously exciting. And this ability to live vicariously through other people and other cultures and other places and leave behind your more sort of normal or monotonous even life, that for me is a great privilege and something I can't imagine ever giving up, although obviously it does come at a price and it does take a toll.
Clearly. The first thing that occurred to me to ask you, it seems as if everything in that world militates against your principal reason for being wherever you are. You are expected to be calm, collected, erudite, and on top of a situation sufficiently to be able to describe it to people who have, in many cases, probably no familiarity with it at all. And everything in that situation is militating against that. It's dangerous. It's unpredictable. There's absolutely no quarter given for the fact that you're female, and that complicates things, as you've mentioned a couple of times in the book.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's why it's not a job for everyone, because it's very natural to be afraid in these situations. And frankly, I would say it's more unnatural if you're not afraid. You should be afraid. But the question is, how do you process fear? How do you deal with fear? How does it manifest itself in that moment? If you're someone who's prone to flapping or panicking, then this is definitely not a job for you. Because in dangerous situations like that, it's absolutely of paramount importance that you maintain at least the facade on the outside of being very calm. So I can be completely panicked and freaked out internally, but on the surface, you will probably only see me get very quiet. And that's essential when you're navigating these types of situations, because any kind of overtly noisy or emotional outbursts can really potentially escalate already dangerous situations even further. So what is happening beneath the surface is not necessarily what's happening above. I mean, you're feeling huge amounts of stress and fear in those moments, but I liken it to being a trauma surgeon, only we're not saving lives. I've just got to get on with it and do my job and stay calm and cool and collected until I get out.
Somebody referred to you as a soldier, and it occurred to me that you are going into situations that soldiers go into, and they too feel that same fear. They have a weapon. You only have a camera. And there are times when that's not much protection at all. The time comes to mind where you were on that bridge in China, and something happened that... First of all, the crowd was upset about what was happening on the ground below, but then at some point that anger shifted to you and your colleagues.
Yeah, that was a very it was a very scary moment. We had basically happened upon a group of Han Chinese who were beating up a Uyghur Muslim man, and this was in the wake of riots where there had been terrible killings on both sides, and it's quite different to watch men kill each other with their hands than using weapons. There's something very intimate about it, very animalistic, extremely disturbing to watch. But a taxi driver came and actually rescued the Uyghur man in question who was being beaten, and it was at that point that the crowd turned their anger on us because we had captured this moment and they felt that it would be giving an unfair representation of the events if we were to transmit that to the world. And so very quickly the situation escalated to the point where they were, brandishing objects at us to hit us with, and then we essentially ran away to our car, and they chased us down the road. And it was very frightening, and it is difficult in those situations, but I would never in a million years trade my camera for a weapon. And I feel, honestly, much safer in situations where I can use my human abilities of conversation and, the ability to communicate with people, either through their own language or another, in order to mitigate some of the risk to these situations. Because I tend to feel that I would be absolutely useless with a weapon. I wouldn't know what to do with it. And I wouldn't really be able to do my job well. I wouldn't be able to talk to people, and I certainly wouldn't be able to talk to people who are also holding weapons. So, yes, I'm very happy with my camera.
Understood. But there's something that happens in a situation like that. I can't say I've ever been in one quite like that, but I've certainly been in situations where there's the sense that people have let go of their essential humanity, and they're just angry, and the air is fraught, and logic disappears, and it's just naked emotion. That's a very... I'm not suggesting that holding a weapon would put you in a better position in that situation. I don't think it matters whether you have a weapon or not. It's more that, in my mind, that's a quintessential example of how complicated the work was that you were doing.
It is. It is complicated. And, you know, and sometimes it does become personal. And I believe me, I've had a number of occasions where people have offered to show me at least how to handle a gun so that I would be able to potentially protect myself in a situation if push came to shove. And I've never opted to take them up on that. I'm sure other journalists have, and it's not that I would say that it would be a bad thing to have that facility with a weapon. It's just for me personally, I can't. I'm also so clumsy, honestly, that I'm almost too frightened to handle a gun. I know that sounds sort of Pollyanna-ish, given the work that I do, but there it is.
Actually, to be honest, to me, Clarissa, it sounds like a very sane response. My feeling is always that when guns are introduced, thinking stops. And as long as you are not holding a weapon, that kind of zen response that you have, you described it at one point in the book, is when things get bloody, you have to take a deep breath and immerse yourself completely in your job, switching off any human response to the horror that's happening. Wow, how long did it take you to be able to do that?
I think it's something that comes naturally to one, in the sense that it's not necessarily something you can learn. I have always had an ability. I mean, obviously, I had never tried and tested it in a war zone up until I started my career, but I had an ability to sort of, I did well in moments of crisis, let's say, you know, if there was blood around or, you know, whatever sort of objectionable or scary thing happening, I was always someone who was able to keep my cool. I think that helped me and made it possible for me to do this kind of work. There's no question that the more you do it, the better you get at being able to balance, you know, your natural emotional response with the requirements of the job.
So it's what they call professionalism.
Yes, it is professionalism, but I know many people, look, it's always educational for me. I remember being kidnapped for the day in eastern Ukraine by pro-Russian separatists, and we were being forced to stand in all these sort of weird stress positions, and we've been blindfolded and driven around. We were only held for the day, I should add, so it ended up not being anywhere near as bad as it could have been. But I was feeling relatively calm. I was, of course, you know, not happy. But I was relatively calm. I'd spent a lot of time in Syria, and I felt that at least in this scenario, I wasn't probably likely to be executed. And so I wasn't worried about being killed. I was a bit worried about being sexually assaulted, but I was largely calm. And there was a young translator who had also been kidnapped with us, and she had not worked in a conflict zone before, and she was crying as we were being sort of put into these bizarre stress positions and stuff, and I was trying to calm her down because we were touching each other's shoulders at one stage. And I do remember having this moment of thinking, this is how a normal person responds to this situation, you know, with fear, with tears. And clearly, you know, it's not to say I'm not a normal person. Of course I am. But my response to some of these situations is not what it would be for most people, yeah.
It strikes me that perhaps it's not so much controlling your emotions as controlling your imagination.
Yes, I think that's a really good way of putting it. You can't, and it's very hard to do. And sometimes I do, I have a very vivid imagination. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the anticipation of something happening is much worse than the actual happening. So I tend to get the most fearful in the run-up to us, like, you know, waiting for our armed escorts to take us into the front lines of Aleppo when I can hear shelling all around. Once I'm on the journey, once I'm on the way, I'm in the moment and I'm kind of committed to it and it's happening. But in the run-up to waiting for that car to arrive, I can experience almost paralyzing fear because my imagination gets carried away and can come up with all sorts of awful things that could quite possibly happen. So, but once you're in the moment, you have to park that.
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting paradox of human nature, isn't it? That which would appear on the outside to be just an awful, frightening situation to be in when you're there, I don't think there's enough time to think about that. You're just reacting to the moment.
You're in shock, and shock is a very effective, human mechanism to cope with incredibly stressful, traumatic situations. So you don't actually really feel anything when you're in shock. You feel like you're underwater, things get very quiet, things move very, very slowly, and you're singularly focused on getting yourself out of whatever situation it is that you're in.
And then you have time to think about it afterwards.
Sometimes quite a bit afterwards, though. This is the thing that people don't understand about trauma. It's not necessarily linear, whereby you see something horrible or experience something frightening and then feel sad about it and feel sort of confused and disturbed by it. Sometimes you don't feel anything for days or weeks or months on end. Sometimes it's only years later that you fully start to process what it is that you've been taking on and absorbing for all that time.
And while you're coping with all that, there's also the other frustration, I think, particularly for somebody like yourself, as you put it, the urge to be human, not a journalist, to intervene, to help in a situation where, particularly as a female, and you are with other women in a situation where their people close to them are in threatened situations. It's natural to want to bond with them and reassure them and help them, but you can't do that.
Well, you know, I mean, I do that sometimes. Not always, but, sometimes you have to be a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to give someone a hug or hold their hand or put the camera down for a moment. Not often, because really, if I don't capture that moment on camera, then I'm not doing my job and I'm not really doing a service to that person in terms of making sure that their story gets told. But I have been known to be a human in the moment and to weep with people on occasion and to give someone a sewing machine if they, I'm thinking particularly of this case of Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh and a woman who had been brutally raped and her child had been killed and she had no way to provide for her family. And, technically I'm not supposed to do that, but if that's the sort of worst ethical breach I've committed as a journalist is to give a woman a sewing machine, then, I'm okay with that. I think it's okay for us to be humans sometimes, but it's about finding that balance.
Yes, I think it is. Yes, and it's not an easy thing to strike. As I said before, I think it's to summarize your book, it is a study in contrast. There's the contrast of who you are and who you are being asked to be so much of the time.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation. I think it's very true in many ways. And it's not an easy job, but wow, it's the greatest job there is in my humble opinion.
And you now have children of your own. And I had the feeling that while that gave you pause, because as your husband pointed out, you're no longer on your own. At the same time, I think maybe they are a source of real solace for you when you're trying to decompress.
They are, because it's such an overwhelming, powerful love. And I have come back from assignments and felt detached from my parents and detached from my friends and detached from my husband. I have never, thank God, felt detached from my children. And I can't imagine a situation in which I could feel detached from them. And the power of that love is so human and so nourishing. And that's hugely important when you're doing this job, because it's on the trips, between the trips, when you come home, that you really fill the tank emotionally, spiritually, physically, in terms of gearing up for that next trip, the tank needs to be full before you can go out again. And so having that love and feeling that connection and feeling grounded with my children is precisely what allows me to keep doing this job in a meaningful way.
And in some sense, is what it all boils down to.
100%. And I think it's improved my reporting. People often assume when you're a mother, oh, you're going to stop going out to dangerous places. And I respect the choice of every woman and, frankly, every man, every father, to change course a bit when they have kids. But for me personally, I take less risks, absolutely, but I still will go to dangerous and difficult places, and I feel more compelled than ever to tell those stories. And I hope that the sort of profound changes that have happened to me as a result of becoming a mother are manifest in my reporting, and that there is more compassion and more humanity in some of the stories I tell.
Yes, that's exactly what just occurred to me, and I would like to congratulate you on your humanity. It comes through on every page in the book.
Thank you.
You are very... You're just the antithesis of what your husband assumed about foreign correspondents and what people think about them. And that has to be a daily exercise, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, you need to stay grounded, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for the book. It was such a pleasure to read it, and I think anybody who reads it will never watch news programs the same way again.
Well, I hope so, because really it's a love letter to journalism as well. And, you know, we're living in times where there's a lot of people disparaging journalism and the work that we do. So I hope it reminds people of how much we put into it, how much we love it and care about it, and how much, you know, hopefully it can have a very positive impact sometimes.
You said, and it's certainly not the first time somebody's made that observation, that television is a very superficial medium. It is another study in contrast that you work in television. Somebody with your heft and your erudition, you know, it's a really powerful force in that medium.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I've very much enjoyed our conversation.
Clarissa Ward is the chief international correspondent for CNN. Her recently published memoir is titled On All Fronts: The Education of a Journalist. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots.